You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New World Pictures Podcast and the sixth annual Roger Corman birthday celebration. We've been doing this for 6 years, almost the entire time we've been a podcast. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, my co-host, Mark.
This is maybe my favorite episode every year.
Oh, so you hate all the rest. Interesting.
I didn't say that. I said maybe my favorite.
Okay. And Erica.
So you're telling me there's a chance that he hates all the rest. Playing it big.
It's gone down on his list for sure. Yeah. And for the first time, we have a guest for our birthday celebration. We are so excited to have on the show. She is a director and producer, and also the author of House of Psychotic Women, an autobiographical topography of female neurosis and horror and exploitation films, and the newly released book, Cockfight, A Fable of Failure. Kayla Janice, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. And great to be here for Roger's birthday, too.
Yes, I'm so glad. Now, I have your book. I'm holding it up. And it's so exciting that you wrote a book about Cockfighter. This is, I'm sure you had a lot of people going, huh, Cockfighter, that's the book you're going to write?
Yeah, no, I definitely had that. I mean, I published it through my own imprint, Spectacular Optical. And part of the reason for that was that nobody was interested in it. Everybody was kind of like, why don't you write a book about Tulane Blacktop instead, you know? You know, so it was kind of like, it was not considered like the canonical Monty Hellman film. And it also was not, it was something that a lot of people found distasteful, right? Because they just knew I was going to be talking about cockfighting a lot in the book. And a lot of people just didn't want to deal with that. You know, I think it turned out like people who read the book since then have thought like, oh, it's actually a lot more interesting than they expected it to be, you know? So, it's a labor of love. That is just a film that I love. It's a film I was obsessed with. It's a film about obsession, you know? So it was like, if I'm going to spend years thinking about one book and being in the headspace of one character, you know, it's going to be this. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of years between your books. I know you've worked on so many projects, in between, but how did you land exactly on Cockfighter being the movie that you wanted to talk about? I mean, you talk about in the book why you love it, which I think is really interesting, but like, why did you finally say, no, this movie above all the others?
Well, it was interesting because I was, I had been obsessed with the film for a very long time, pretty much since, you know, I obviously wasn't, I'm not old enough to have been around the first wave of Cockfighter, but it was basically when Anchor Bay released the DVD, right? So this would have been about 1999. The first DVD came out. They started kind of rescuing Monty Hellman's films from obscurity and putting them out on DVD. And they released several of his films, but Cockfighter was the one that I just loved, you know, and part of what I loved about it was that it was about a disgusting subculture, you know, like it was about this subculture that I just knew a lot of people wouldn't get into that aspect of it, you know, and for me, that just became fascinating, the sort of characters that it lived in that milieu and their codes of ethics and stuff like this. And just the way that morality works in the film, because it's basically like, it's like people have their honor codes, they have their morality codes, but there's these kind of carve outs for things that in larger society would be against our moral codes, you know? And yeah. So I moved to the States. I moved down to Texas for 4 years. And at the time, cockfighting was illegal everywhere in the States except for Louisiana, which was the state over from Texas. And so we lived 2 hours from the border. And so me and some friends were just like, let's go see a cockfight, you know? So we went over the border to see it. And I just became obsessed with that too. You're not dealing with fast editing like in a movie, you know? So this is like a whole day. Basically, when you go to a cockfight, it's just like a whole day of everybody sitting there in the bleachers, and it's just fight after fight after fight, you know? And But the family, I mean, it was like a family event. It was like the place is full of kids running around, you know. And I just found it so interesting, the people that made their living doing that, you know, and people are betting against each other. And there's a lot of money going back and forth. You know, there's people who were like me. I was betting like a dollar because I didn't have a lot of money. But there's people betting like thousands of dollars and stuff, you know. And so you have all these different hierarchies of class and everything all kind of in the same room, you know. But I still hadn't thought of making a book out of it, you know. And then I went and visited. I think I went to stay with Monty Hellman first before I, you know. So he used to have an Airbnb at his house, and so I heard about this, and I was like, oh, I want to go stay with Monty Hellman. So I went and stayed at the Airbnb. But at that point, I was not planning on writing a book. You know, the idea of the book actually came after that trip. And a big part of it was because he told me he thought it was the worst movie he ever made. And I was, you know, I was like, but that's my favorite movie of yours. And he actually was really put off by that. The fact that, you know, he just thought I must have no taste in movies at all, if that was my favorite movie that he ever made. And, you know, so I sort of went away after that trip thinking I need to prove to Monty Hellman that this movie is special, you know. And that was really kind of the impetus for the book, was the fact that he rejected it so harshly. And it was just like, I need to prove to him why I love this movie so much, you know.
Yeah, in the book you talk about staying at his Airbnb, and that he would often talk about movies to his guests. Did you ever get him to talk to you about movies other than the fact that he didn't like Cockfighter? Did you get to talk with him at all about his movies?
Yeah. I mean, like we watched, what did we watch? I think we watched Ride in the Whirlwind together.
Oh, wow.
So he had, yeah, like just in his little movie room or whatever, you know, we went and sat in there and we watched it. And it was so weird because I was just like, as a person who makes films, I don't want to watch my film with somebody sitting next to me, you know? Yeah. So, but I thought it was kind of weird that he just wanted to watch his film with me. I think maybe he was trying to prove to me that he had other better movies. And it's like, I have seen these movies. I don't disagree with you that they're good, but I felt like we were doing this opposite thing where he's trying to prove to me that his other movies are better. You know, but Tulane Blacktop was the one that he obviously loved because he had giant posters of it in his house, in multiple places. And he told a lot of stories about, I mean, he just showed me stuff that I think he showed everybody that stayed there, you know, like he pulled out pictures that he had taken of Laurie Bird and stuff like this. And, you know, and the one sort of funny thing was when I said that, Cockfighter was, when he said that Cockfighter was the worst movie he ever made, I said, what about Silent Night, Deadly Night 3? and he was like, I like Silent Night, Deadly Night 3. So he actually thought Silent Night, Deadly Night 3 was a way better movie than Cockfighter.
Brain bowl.
And, you know, part of that was he felt he had control over it. You know, he felt like he didn't have the control over Cockfighter that he wanted. And he felt like with Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, he got to make the movie that he envisioned, you know, so it didn't matter to him if other people thought it was good or not. It was like he had an idea for what he wanted to do and he was able to do it. You know, with Cockfighter, he felt everything was compromised. You know, he felt like he didn't get to finish the rewrite of the script the way he wanted to. He didn't get to, I mean, that was his main problem with it, was that he didn't like the script, you know, that Charles Wilford had written.
He also didn't shoot the cockfights, right?
No, he shot cockfights. There was just pickups, you know, so there was like, there was pickups that were shot like second unit type stuff that were shot
by Lewis
after
Teague.
The fact. So they sort of, so they shot the movie and then Corman thought there's not enough cockfighting or not, basically not enough like close-ups, you know. So there were there was stuff that Monty shot that where you can see the whole cockpit, you know, so you can see the whole area. But what Corman wanted was he thought there should be more close-ups on the chickens, you know, and on their gaffs, you know, which are like the hooks that they wear and stuff like that. Monty didn't get that stuff, and so they basically had to set up a secondary shoot, which was actually done in a driveway in Los Angeles. But because everything was close up, it didn't matter because you didn't really see the environment. You just saw the close-ups of like the birds and the feathers and stuff like that. So that stuff was shot in a totally different place with totally different people and inserted later. But yeah, but he was definitely around for the cockfights and he did film them and stuff, but he just wasn't interested in them. You know? Yeah. So he didn't try to focus on it so much.
Yeah, that's what's interesting too about your book. You have these letters that are going back and forth between Charles Williford and Frances Dole and Roger Corman, or Frances Kimbrough as she mm-hmm. was at the time. And and talking about how they actually had to pull cockfights out of the script. They wanted to like get rid of those, which is funny because I'm like, well, didn't they go back and shoot more? It's sort of funny that they had to cut some out.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's different on paper, right? So you sure. do something on paper, and part of that is to try to get money, try to get like financiers and stuff. You sort of pull out the sort of stuff that they're going to be more offended by, and then I'm sure once they looked at the footage. Corman, you know, I don't think he could have been too surprised. I think a lot of people, when they talk about it, like Joe Dante and John Davison and stuff, when they talk about it, they're like, well, Roger was disappointed because he expected this action movie and stuff. And it's like, how could he expect that? If he hired Monty Hellman. He yeah. knew he'd worked with Monty Hellman on several movies. He knows right. the guy's not going to make some action-packed, like Moonshine Express type movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I don't think he was too surprised. I think he just looked at it and he just thought, you know, here and there, the pacing needed to be punched up with some close-ups. You know, it was just kind of like, you know, and it wasn't even drastically different, you know, like, I mean, it was just, yeah. And some of those shots are beautiful, actually. So, yeah.
You also did talk to a lot of people that worked on the movie. I was curious, were there yeah. anybody that you didn't want to be interviewed or didn't agree to an interview?
Yeah. So both casting agents didn't want to be interviewed. They were just like, worst garbage I ever worked on. And that was kind of all they would say. And then also Michael Frank, who did the movie. Was it Frank? Frank or Franks? Michael Franks, who did the music. I actually never spoke to him directly. I spoke to his agent. His agent wanted $10,000 for him to do an interview. So I was like, no. I'm like, okay, well, he won't have any quotes in the book then, you know. I'm trying to think if there was other people. I mean, you know, there was a lot of people who didn't like the movie, but a lot of those people are dead, you know? So people like mm-hmm. Harry Dean Stanton, I originally was going to do an interview with him and he died like a month before I came to LA to do it. So, yeah, so that was unfortunate. But at the same time, he's been interviewed a lot, you know, and there's a lot of, I use a lot of other people's interviews in my book, you know, because mm-hmm. luckily, you know, people who interviewed Warren Oates and Harry Dean Stanton, like I can't interview those people, but they were asked about those movies in other interviews. And Harry Dean Stanton was pretty obvious about his disdain. The one person actually that I really, really wanted to get that I just couldn't get a response from was Patricia Piercy. So Patricia Piercy, who plays Frank's sort of love interest back, I called her so many times. I even had a family member like intervening on my behalf, trying to convince her to do it. And I don't really know why she wouldn't do it, because years ago I had spoken to her when I lived in Austin. I used to program for the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema, and I taught, and she used to teach acting classes in Austin. So I just called her up one day and I said, hey, we're thinking of playing Cockfighter, you know, would you come and do a Q&A or whatever? And she was like, oh yeah, absolutely, I'd love to, you know? So she, at the time she was really enthusiastic about it. And then when it came to doing my book, like, which was, you know, 15 years later or something, I just couldn't get any response, even though I knew my messages were getting to her. You know, it was like her voice on the answering machine, and it was like her sister-in-law was the one who kept asking her for me. And she just was like, you know, I told her you want to reach her. It's up to her to contact you, you know. And yeah, she just didn't. And it was, you know, it's unfortunate because I felt like there are so few women in the movie Cockfighter, mm-hmm. you know, that and Laurie Bird is gone. And also, everybody said everybody had bad things to say about Laurie Bird, you know? So, like, Stephen Gatos, who was a PA on the movie, was like the only person that liked her that had nice things to say about her. Everybody hated her. And so I felt like, God, you know, it's like so few women in the movie, and the only things being said are nasty things, you know? But it was like, that's what happens. Fortunately, when, you know, it's like the people who do the interviews are the people who end up shaping the history, you know. So
You did get to speak to Ed Begley Jr.
He didn't want to do an so you're right, he didn't want to do an interview. I actually got a lot of stuff from his biography, right? So he had just published an autobiography. I tried to get him for like 10 years. And you know, I kept going through various managers, and I also went through friends. I had like two friends in common with him, you know, who were actually pretty pissed off that, you know, that they vouched for me and he still didn't do it. And then, you know, by the time, you know, then when his book came out, I thought, well, surely I'll be able to get an interview with him now because he'll be doing press for his book, right? So he'll just be able to look at it as like just some PR for his book or whatever. But and so I finally did get a hold of his manager, because he had several managers and they also changed over time. But so I got a manager who was enthusiastic about me doing the interview. But then he just came back and said Ed couldn't remember anything. He's like, well, he'd be happy to do an interview with you, but he just can't remember anything. And so there was stuff that he talked about. There was stuff that basically Charles Wilford had mentioned in Cockfighter Journal. He talks about Ed Begley quite a bit. And so there were certain things I was trying to cross-reference from Ed Begley's book, mainly about the fact that he when he arrived on set, he arrived from a murder scene being discovered in his backyard, you know? So it was like when he left to come to Atlanta for the shoot, there had been a woman's body found in his garbage, behind his house. And so he went from that immediate discovery of watching the police pull a woman out of his garbage in pieces to getting on a plane and going to Cockfighter and telling other people on set about this, you know. So he talks about that incident in his book. He doesn't connect it to Cockfighter or what he was shooting around the time, really, or anything like, you know, but he remembers the incident of the woman being found in his garbage. And how traumatizing that was to him. And so some of that I was able to use in my book and then put it kind of side by side with some of the things Charles Wilford had told in his journal. Because, you know, Charles Wilford, you know, he told that story, but I didn't know how accurately he was telling that story, you know, and then it was basically totally corroborated in Ed Begley Jr.'s book. So come to think of it, there were a lot of people who didn't want to talk to me.
Well, I'm glad that you didn't have there wasn't like long passages in his book and he was like, I don't remember anything, but then he talks about it in detail in his book, because that would have
no Cockfighter gets barely a mention in his book, you know. The only things he really said about Cockfighter was that he did it because he was friends with Harry Dean Stanton, and Harry Dean Stanton was going to be in the movie, and he thought, oh, I'll go be in this movie and then I can hang out and, you know, have a few jars with Harry Dean Stanton. That was about it. So
a good enough reason to do anything, to be honest. Now, do you think that Corman would have made a Cockfighter if he had read the original book before he decided to buy it?
I mean, it's possible he still would have optioned it, you know, but made, you know, but he would have gone in knowing that he was going to have to, you know, he wouldn't have hired the writer of the book to write the script. I think, you know, he would, you know, could have looked at it and been like, you know, I can make something out of this. And then he would have hired somebody to do something totally different. So I think the fact that he actually optioned it and hired the author to write the script meant that, you know, you're hiring somebody, A, who's experienced at writing scripts. So he's kind of learning on the job, and writing a book is totally different from writing a script. But I think Roger, if he had read the book, he probably wouldn't have hired Charles Wilford to do it. He would have hired one of his more kind of regular guys who write a punchy sort of Southern drive-in movie out of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also he paid him a good amount of money, especially for what Roger paid writers. if I have
Yeah,
the
I
sun
don't
right.
remember what it was, but
I
yeah.
mean, at the time we did our
I don't
episode on
remember
it,
what it was.
I think it was 10. I had a number of 10,000. That maybe that's not correct, but that seems a little high for Roger to
Yeah.
spend on a script. Maybe that was for like the rights of the book and for him to write the script. Maybe that was the whole thing.
Yeah.
Still feels like a
Because I
lot for
know that
Roger.
when it came time for Monty Hellman to do rewrites, and he wanted to get Monty wanted to hire Earl MacRoush to do rewrites, Corman wouldn't give any money towards that. He was kind of like, "No, I've already paid for the writing, so we're done." But Earl MacRoush was a really he was another person I tried for a long time to get, and it was like the last minute. The only reason I got Earl MacRoush was because I always say Mac. MacRoush, as though it's one name, but Mac is actually his nickname. But anyways, he wrote to Buckaroo Banzai and stuff. And but I'd been trying to get a hold of him just from, but it was like people who had worked the Buckaroo Banzai Blu-ray and stuff, like were not able to reach him. And I can't remember how I emailed him. I think I got in touch with him, or I got a message sent to him from oh my God, what is his name? The director of Buckaroo Banzai. Is it W.D. Richter? The same agent or something, right? So it was like I contacted the agent of the director of Buckaroo Banzai and was like, "Can you please ask your client if he can get my message to MacRoush?" And nothing happened. And then I was going to print with the book. I had a print deadline. It was supposed to be handed into the, and my designer was like, it was just not done. Like we needed another day or two of layout. It was not going to make this deadline. And I was really bummed out because I had to call the printer and be like, we're not going to make this deadline. We need another few days. And because of that, it meant we were going to lose our spot and the book was going to be delayed, And I already had a book launch set up for it. And it basically meant we were going to miss the book launch. So I was so bummed out. And then the next morning, I got an email from Earl or Mac, I got an email and I was like, "Oh my God, this is actually a miracle." This is because if I had handed in my book on time, you wouldn't have been in the book. And I said, "Are you willing to do an interview like now, like right now?" And he was like, "Yes." So that was literally squeaked under the finish line to get in the book, because it was like our printer was there waiting, and we got everything. I got him added in like 2 days,
That is amazing. Yeah, I got to think, do you like write the book like before you get the interviews? Do you start with the interviews and then write the book from there, or is it all like sort of at the same time?
No, usually I do the interview first, and then I start kind of building it out from there, so it's like I'll usually do interviews and then I'll do a bunch of, so there's a certain amount of research I'll do to do the interview, then I'll do the interview, then I'll start doing more research, and then more questions will come up, and then I'll usually do more interviews, or interview the same people again. And like Roger Corman, I was emailing questions to all the time, trying to get clarification on things,
Yeah, I was about to ask how if he was receptive to helping out.
Oh yeah, no, he was receptive and he remembered, like he remembered a lot, because there was even just questions I was asking about the Southern Drive-In Circuit and the names for the different depots, and what regions had what bookers, and because I was trying to put together a picture in my mind of where the film actually opened and when it opened, because it had an unusual release. And so I kept going back to Roger with, asking for clarification. And then, so I had like my formal interviews with him, which were recorded, and then I also had emails, which were recorded in writing. But then I also had a couple of just social times with him, where nothing was recorded, but he was telling me anecdotes, so the story about his being a cockfighter, something that he told me for his birthday. So it was like his birthday and we went to the smokehouse in Los Angeles. So there it was like me and Roger Corman and Joe Dante, John Davison. And it was like John Davison had invited me out to LA because they had just made a new print, a new 35 millimeter print of Cockfighter from the negatives. And they were looking at it for the first time, this print, to see what it looked like. And so Monty was there, and Joe Dante, John Davison, Roger, you know, a bunch of the old sort of New World people, you know. And we watched, you know, so I got invited to this thing because John Davison knew I was doing a book about Cockfighter. And so then afterwards, it was like Roger's birthday, or it was a couple days away from Roger's birthday. So everybody's like, let's go take Roger out to the smokehouse for his birthday. And so we went there. And so then he told me, he just told a bunch, I was seated right next to him, and he told a whole bunch of more stories at that lunch, you know. And yeah, he was just sharp as a whip, you know, like, I mean, he just, he remembered so much compared to, you know, for his age, but also compared to like everybody else around him, you know. So, and he was so interested in everything, you know. He was so curious about how the business worked now. Everybody else at the table, there was like people from the Academy archive and stuff, and he was just really curious about how film exhibition worked now, and you know, just kind of eternally curious about everything.
Yeah, was that print that they struck? I imagine that was for the Shout Factory, like Blu-ray that they made from it. Was that for
it's
that?
Totally or? Separate.
Okay.
No, it's totally separate. It was basically John Davison and Joe Dante have this like film archive collection mm-hmm, together. Mm-hmm. And I think it was John Davison, Roger Corman, and the Academy Film Archive all split expenses on an ongoing project where they were restoring just a bunch of, they were like doing photochemical restorations, you know? So they weren't making DCPs. They're doing photochemical restorations, film prints. And so whatever they would have to do for the Blu-ray is a different process, you know, when you're doing it for digital.
Sure. I just wondered if they made the print so they could then make the Blu-ray. That's what I was wondering. But
yeah, I don't think so. I think it was actually separate, because like that Shout Factory Blu-ray clearly has no involvement from anyone on it. It's like,
yeah,
it's got no extras, you know,
nothing
like,
on it, bare bones.
It's like they released it, you know, Whisper, like a year before the 50th anniversary of the film.
Yeah.
And like, I've begged them to like license us the film to Severin. You know, I was trying to get the film out. I was like, can we please license Cockfighter from, so that we can do a proper release and like put it with a book and do a 50th anniversary edition, and we will get all the extras, you know? And they were like, nope, they wouldn't let us do it. So
yeah.
It was, yeah, I just thought, what a waste, you know? Like, I mean.
Yeah, they keep putting out like,
it's like,
lots
why
of
do you even want this library?
Yeah, they keep putting out new editions of some of the old films, but they don't add any. I mean, if there were extras in the original DVD release, they'll keep those, but they don't do anything new. And for us as a podcast, it's pretty frustrating, because, you know, we like the newer version, but it's like, I would love more context for certain things, and their unwillingness to go out to people when there's plenty of people who will talk about the movie. It's kind of it's a bummer, because Roger has passed. This is year two that we've been doing his birthday celebration, and he's passed away. It's so awesome you got a chance to meet him. He really was, when he passed, he was somebody that we just thought at some point we would get a chance to talk with him. We just thought, but even though I mean, he was 98 years old at that point in time, but we just assumed we will get a chance. And unfortunately we did not. But you got to meet him, which is fantastic. And
I got to meet him a few times, actually, because he was also at several festivals that I've been at over the years, where I've been at a dinner with him and stuff. So,
and it's great to hear that he's still,
I mean,
it was great though that he still felt, he was still so curious, and he was still so interested in all the things that were going on with the industry. That just makes me really happy to hear. And let's transition. Let's get into our celebration of Roger Corman. We're going to talk about a bunch of different movies, and how this has always worked is that when we did our very first Roger Corman celebration, we had planned to watch one movie. Unfortunately, Mark didn't understand what that movie was, and he watched something else. And so
I understood what the homework assignment was. I just, there was some fine print in the homework assignment that I you know, I wear glasses. I couldn't read it. It was
I
very
guess.
small, and I made a mistake. And it has forever transformed, I think, in a good way, this birthday celebration.
I mean, it's weird that you couldn't understand House of Usher and you thought that that meant something else. I don't,
Mask of the Red Death,
I
which
don't
is, you know,
know.
kind of same, right? It's
Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, they do share that. I do think that that's that. Yeah, sure. You were nearish. You were like, so since then we will go off and watch a Roger Corman movie, and then we'll come back and sort of surprise each other with what that is. And you have chosen one as well. And but let's if we can, we can just start with Mark. Mark, tell us a little bit about your movie, and we'll get into talking about it.
So I watched I wanted to one of the last episodes that we did, or it wasn't the last episode, but the one before, I talked about Frankenstein Unbound. So I, you know, started with his big studio film. And this time I wanted to go way back in the time machine to one of his earlier films and dig into his Western films.
Oh, okay.
So I watched
Ooh.
1956's Gunslinger.
This is more than the story of a colorful man. It's the reliving of an era in a time without morals, of the kind of adventures the historians of the West only whisper about.
What's your business in Oracle?
It's honest.
How long is it going to take you to finish it up?
I think I can finish in 5 days. But that also gives me 5 nights. What do you do nights, Miss Marshall?
Terror is a silent witness to nerve-snapping suspense as the gunslinger meets a man who fears him, a woman who hates him, in a triangle that reaches mass supremacy.
This is written by Charles B. Griffith and Mark Hanna. It stars John Ireland of Waxwork 2 fame. I know he did a lot of other movies, but that's what I remember him. Beverly Garland,
It's
who
your
was in.
touchstone. That's what matters.
Beverly Garland, who was in Christmas Vacation 2, Cousin Eddie's Island Adventure, Allison Hayes, who was in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, and William Shalit, who was in Innerspace, and one episode of Parker Lewis Can't Lose. So I figured with that cast, how could I go wrong?
You couldn't.
No, you can't. And there's even a small, there is an appearance by Dick Miller. Now, I watched this twice. I'm not sure which character he is, but you know, it is 1956. It's a smaller part, so, and in a movie with not that many characters, I thought, okay, well, I'm sure I'll find spot him, but I didn't. But I digress.
But in John
This,
Ireland, we had just watched him in Maniac.
yes, we did. We
Yeah,
did.
aka Assault on Paradise.
Exactly. And so I'm trying to keep that whole theme going. Watching our next, the next movie I watch has to have a character from the previous movie that we watched. I'm trying to see if I can make this work.
Mark, you have a lot of rules for somebody who didn't understand the original rules of the birthday
Well,
episode.
look at how you've grown.
Look at you.
The thing that I
You went from not knowing what House of Usher was to just creating all these different rules and for you to follow.
Well, the one thing
I'm
that
proud
I'm
of
good
you.
at is reading the terms and conditions.
You
And this is all in the terms and
had to
conditions, which
really go
evidently
back.
you haven't read. So this is a Western shot in Calabasas. They shot it in 6 days. They
Ooh.
shot it on a set in Calabasas, one of the Western sets that was there. From what I read, it poured rain at the time. The union had said that they wouldn't work longer than 5 days, and this was just about to be passed, that everyone got a proper weekend. And so Roger rushed this to try and get a full 6 days out of everybody before that took hold. They had a bunch of rain, which made the set constantly muddy. At one point in time, Allison Hayes was riding a horse, and the horse slipped. She fell, broke her arm, and they had to just try to get some pickup shots of her up close to try and weave her back into the movie, even though she plays a significant character in the movie. Pretty much everyone in the movie said that they were having a miserable time shooting this. But Beverly Garland ultimately gave it a lot of praise because the movie is about she is the wife of the marshal of the small town in Texas, And in the very beginning, he gets shot and killed. And she assumes she two got two assailants come into or come to the police station. They one of them shoots him through a window. She picks up a gun immediately, runs out, shoots one of the guys. One of the guys gets away. And now she's on a mission to find the people who killed her husband.
Like a revenge story.
It's a revenge story. But she also, in the meantime, because they can't get a new marshal for 6 days, she takes on the role of the marshal. So she's the town police sheriff for the 6 days. So one of the things she really loved about this movie is just having a female hero in a Western at that time. You know, Roger Corman would often, you know, go against stereotypes in his movie plots. And this was one of those where he was, you know, making the woman the hero. And she loved being like, she said, I think I was the first police sheriff, female police sheriff in any Western ever at that time. And I haven't fact checked it, but I have to trust that she was correct about that. So she's got 6 days to find the person that the other guy who killed her husband. She does the next day at the funeral because he shows up just to see what's going on. And while the casket has not even been dropped in the ground and she's standing on one side of the casket and he walks up to observe what's going on the other side, she shoots him from 4 feet away, which is pretty shocking. Like, you didn't expect that to happen.
Yeah, he didn't see it coming.
So in the meantime, there is Erica Page, who's played by Allison Hayes, who she owns the bar / brothel, who doesn't like Rose. Rose is of course, the Beverly Garland's character, who is now the police sheriff. And they don't get along with each other. And Rose tells her that you've got to close up your shop at 3 o'clock, because at 3 a.m., that's when all businesses must close. Erica says, no, we're open for 24 hours. They proceed to get into a fist fight. And Erica decides to, she tells her bartender / friend / guy who's really into her, but she's not into him, to go find someone to kill Rose. So he goes off and he finds Kane, who is wanted in 4 different states. He comes into town presumably to kill Rose, the sheriff. But he's really there to kill the mayor of the town, because the mayor, when they were in the war,
Twist.
Ran, and he was there with his brothers, and they were in a big battle, and the mayor ran, and all of his brothers died, and he's been waiting to get his revenge for years.
Double revenge. This is a double revenge story.
It's a double revenge.
So much revenge going on.
Erica also had a romantic relationship with him in the past, so she's super excited to see him.
You're not talking about Erica in our show, right? You're talking about her. No. Okay, in the movie. No. Okay. No. Okay. In I was movie. Like, in that would movie. Be weird if it was Erica, but
Erica,
okay.
the brothel owner.
Erica owns a brothel? Wait, I'm confused. I'm sorry. It's just
everybody
the name.
Needs a side hustle, Ryan. Come on, get with the times.
Fair enough. Who am I to judge? Correct.
Yeah. It's either brotheling or Ubering. You know, you got to pick. Got to pick one. You got to get that side hustle.
Both very profitable. Drive.
Hate to drive, but I love to get people satisfied.
There's a lot of ways you could have gone with
industries,
that.
Both industries help with those things. So
they do.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a subplot with a train coming into town, and Erica's been buying up a bunch of property, and she's
subplot with a train. Go
it's
on.
It's not clear if the train station, if it comes into town, it makes her situation worse or better. I couldn't really track that part, but she's trying to scam the whole town and make as much money as she can. Meanwhile, the sheriff has told her, you have 6 days to leave the town. Coincidentally, Kane has 6 days to kill the mayor. And we spend 6 days of them almost killing each other before the big ending. You know,
what did you think of this movie?
Yeah, this is a low budget movie. Low budget Western. You know, it's one of those. We watch a lot of Westerns and we know it's a set. And they do a really good job of shooting when you go inside a building or outside a building, to not open the door too wide because you'll see that there's nothing in the building. This movie doesn't abide by those rules.
Doesn't worry It's not worried.
Get some wide open. Hey, that's just a big black box behind that door.
Don't look out the windows. What are you doing? It's a movie.
Right. There's a lot of fighting on the sets that happen inside those buildings. The walls sometimes shake when people hit them. So it's a low budget movie. But for a movie that has
those flats aren't true walls, you know? No, I mean, they really
not. They are not.
You had 6 days. Tell. You had 6 days.
And it's for having a simple plot. The plot is actually quite complex because there's a lot of double crossing going on. All the actors, especially Beverly Garland and Allison Hayes, are awesome in their roles. You do get a little more overcranked horse chase scenes than maybe you want. Obviously, it was raining a lot.
I can't get enough when I watch a Western. I want all the horse riding to be double cranked.
Where on even two if they're sides talking. Of the spectrum.
Even if there's dialogue going on.
You like to get that sort of like high-pitched voice going.
I'm going chipmunk it. Let's do it.
Nip on the helium balloon before this scene. Yeah.
Let's go for it.
But I really enjoyed it. It has poor reviews on IMDb. I think it's 3.5 out of 10, 3.8. But, you know, the knocks on it are that it looks like a low-budget movie. But I think the fact that it was shot in 6 days, the fact that the actors are doing an incredible job, they're definitely delivering higher than their pay grade. It's an enjoyable movie, and with a lot of plot twists. Who's trying to really outdo who in this movie? Who's really going to double cross the other one? It keeps you interested all the way to the end, and the end is it's a good ending. It's not a happy ending, but it's a good ending. Mm. So I really enjoyed it.
Good, good. And Kayla, have you seen this?
No. No, I have not. Although I'm really interested in the idea of if there's a female marshal, because I wrote a piece about women-led Westerns, like older women-led Westerns a while ago, mostly focused on Euro Westerns. And so I'm always sort of up for collecting these recommendations of Westerns that have really strong female roles in them. So
and
I'm interested.
Definitely not. She's strong through the whole movie. You know, she's not, they really play her as a very strong willed, confident. She's not ever a damsel in distress. There's none of those moments. Like she, at one point in time, some of the ladies from the brothel try to hang her from a tree, but I can't blame her for being like, "Hey, someone help me with this one. I'm being overpowered." Outside of like that, which is not a damsel in distress moment, but like she has a mission. She's going to make it. She's going to see it through, and she's going to make sure everyone's on the same page. And she does a really great job.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of the Roger Corman Westerns. Of course, famously, that's like when he started on the Fox lot and would ride a bike around and deliver mail. And he ended up doing reading scripts and doing notes. And of course, he did notes for The Gunfighter, which is a Gregory Peck Western. And he got no credit for his notes. And that's what made him go, I don't want to work at Fox. I want to go out on my own because I apparently have good ideas, but I'm not going to get any credit. So forget this. I wonder if Gunslinger had anything to do with Gunfighter. I just wonder if it maybe just by name and just wanted to do something similar. But he has a few that he started his career on. So I didn't know if we were going to get to what was the early one, Apache Woman or Five Guns West. I know those are some of the early ones, you know, one of the first ones that he did. But yeah, that's great. I need to get into more of his Westerns. Kayla, let's go to you. What was your movie? What did you watch? What were you when we told you we were going to watch one of these movies? Did you know right away what you were going to watch, or did you think what am I interested in?
I did not know right away, but I did know that I wanted to go back pretty far. You know, I wanted to go back to the early years also. So my movie is from 1957. And I'm super interested in juvenile delinquent films. I love juvenile delinquent films from all eras, pretty much. So I knew I was probably going to be looking into the JD films he made and find one that I hadn't seen. And I originally started watching Teenage Doll and then realized a few minutes into it that I actually had seen it already. So then I switched to Sorority Girl.
I'm Sabra, a sorority girl. And to all appearances, I have everything a sorority girl could want. The kind of figure built to wear clothes and the clothes to wear. A dreamboat of a car. A man-stopping smile. And best of all, no inhibitions. But there is a strangeness within me, too. A hunger to hurt. And with it, a mysterious power that seems to search out those who are prey for my sinister enjoyments.
I won't do it. It's not right.
I know it's not right. But meanwhile, that'll help pay enough for both of us.
You're the one that made me pregnant.
Tina, I've never touched you, and you know I'm not the father.
No, but I'll say you are. You've got 1,000 to spare, and I want it by tomorrow night.
All these are easy victims to gratify my cruel savagery.
Which is really interesting because I wouldn't even call it a JD movie, even though it kind of looks that way from the marketing. It kind of begins, it begins and ends very similar to like Let's Scare Jessica to Death, you know, really? Where you have this sort of ethereal voice of this woman who's, you know, she's like on the water's edge and she's, you know, if only I could go back to the beginning and nobody knows what it's like to be hated as much as I'm hated, you know, and then it's kind of got the dreamy, like, you know, and, you know, so I was, so right away I was kind of like, oh, this is interesting. This is actually, you know, the more I watched it, the more I realized like this movie could be in my book, House of Psychotic Women, you know, like because the whole movie, I don't know if you guys have seen it or not, but she's basically a sociopath. So she's this woman in a sorority. It's Susan Cabot, who's also in The Wasp Woman. Mm-hmm. And she's in a sorority and she's basically just like shit stirring, you know, she's basically just like finding ways to like just dig into the weak points of all the various sorority girls that she's in her house with for no reason. She's just compelled to like fuck their lives up and hurt them, you know. And you know, she's got this little, there's like a pledge, there seems to be only one pledge, you know, so in all these movies there's usually like a gaggle of pledges that are being treated horribly. In this one there's just one, so there's like one pledge that she treats like crap. She treats her like her little slave pretty much. But then all the other girls, there's like Barbara Morris, who was actually Monty Hellman's wife at the time that the movie was made, plays one of the girls in the film who's sort of political aspirations, you know. And her boyfriend is played by Dick Miller, and he sort of runs a local bar and employs some of the girls, you know, but he's got a good reputation. He's like an upstanding community guy. All the people seem older, you know, than they're supposed to be. But the girl basically just finds ways to, you know, she's like, oh, this person is interested in Dick Miller's character. I'll just go make out with him and screw up that relationship for no reason. And this other girl talks in her sleep about how she's pregnant. You know, so she blackmails that girl, you know, and then at one point she has this kind of moment of lucidity where she realizes she's a horrible person. And she goes and finds her mother and she just cries and is like, mother, I'm sick. Something's wrong with me. I need you. You need to help me. And her mother's like, you know, what's wrong with you, child? Grow up, you know, like act like an adult. And so you realize like so much of her shitty behavior is really like her mom is a horrible person as well. So some of it is definitely environmental, you know, but she has this very strong drive to just hurt people and you know, and some of them physically, she physically hurts people too. And so she just goes around ruining people's lives until eventually they figure out that she's behind all these things and they kind of corner her on the beach. And then she has the, I mean, I always talk about endings. Am I allowed to talk about the ending?
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Spoilers for Sorority Girl.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah, everybody was mad because I talked about the endings of all the movies in my book, but that's because usually when you're trying to talk about the character, the thing actually becomes important, like what they do in their final moments. And in this movie, she just walks into the sea, you know, which is actually my favorite kind of ending of any movie. Like, I actually love movies awesome. Where the character just walks into the sea at the end, like Frankenstein, you know, or like Interiors, the Woody Allen movie. Like, there's so many movies like this where like a woman just walks into the sea and just obliterates her, just disappears in the waves, you know. And so I was like, oh, this has my favorite kind of ending. You know, so it was great. It's fun watching some of the early movies too, because you know that some of the people all crisscross in so many of the other movies. You know, like a lot of the actors are in, you know, a lot of the exact same actors and everything are in the other movie that I started watching, in Teenage Doll. You know, in this credit sequence, there's this great sort of charcoal animated sequence by Bill Martin, and he also does a similar sequence for the beginning of Teenage Doll. So there's a lot of sharing of cast and crew through these movies. And then just thinking about things like Barbara Morris being Monty Hellman's wife, you know, and he ran this like little theater company at the time. And it was, you know, it's like Corman said at some point that it was actually making this film and realizing something about the central character's performance that he needed to understand more about acting. And that was actually what prompted him. You know, there's lots of stories about how he took acting lessons, and that was how he met Jack Nicholson and met a bunch of these people, was like in the acting classes that he took. But apparently it was this movie that prompted him to go and take those acting classes. And so, you know, you start to see a lot of these connections that will come up creatively through all these people. It's like in the Corman school or whatever, you have people, there's a lot of mobility, people moving around in different positions. They start as an actress and then they're a producer or they're a writer, or, you know, he finds people's strengths, you know. But yeah, so it's like in a lot of these early, in these 50s movies, you can see a lot of people that he just keeps working with in some capacity throughout the next 20 years or so.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have not seen this. Have you guys seen this movie?
No, I haven't. No.
Yeah. Haven't seen. I think the only the closest of his movies that I've seen to this is maybe Swamp Women, but that's really more of closer to, not as sort of juvenile delinquent. It's a little bit closer to like the Women in Prison movies that he would make later, but Swamp Women is also how I believe he first started working with the Woolners, who Larry Woolner eventually he starts New World with, which, by the way, I wanted to compliment you, not just such a great book on Cockfighter, but also like a really wonderful, like and just concise history on New World that's in the book. If people want to get like a really lovely little of how that sort of starts, what his Rogers in you know, inspiration was, really well done.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Larry, it was interesting because Larry Woolner was the producer of the other. So the other movie that I was going to watch, Teenage Doll, even though I said it has the same kind of title sequence, same cast, you know, for the most part. But that one was produced by Larry Woolner, and Sorority Girls produced by AIP. So it's kind of interesting that he's kind of doing the same thing for both companies, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you can just see some like experimentation happening there, you know, like seeing basically making similar movies for different companies to see who's going to release it, what the you know, like what the results of that collaboration are going to be. If you have a similar product releasing through two different companies, you know, and you have so many of the same elements, so many of the same actors, so many of the same sort of aesthetic touches and stuff like that, but like what is going to make the difference if you have a different company releasing the film? And so I felt like, you know, he might have been doing some kind of business recon, you know, in release and doing those movies kind of so close together with different people, you know.
Yeah, well, he certainly used the Woolners a lot because they had the chain of you know, theaters and stuff. So and of course starts New World, and we have Larry Woolner to thank for Five Nurses movies, because he's the one that comes up with that concept and then quickly rushes off and starts the early Dimension Pictures in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Stephanie Rothman. But that sounds great. I got to check this one out. I'm really interested in some of his sort of those early stages up until like in New World. We obviously talk a lot about the women in prison movies, and this is sort of, I feel like, the genesis of those, these sort of like juvenile delinquent movies. Mm-hmm. So very interested to check this out. For our movie that Eric and I watched, I sort of chose it, and I chose it because I know it's a popular one amongst a lot of people, particularly people that work for Roger. This is a lot of people's favorite of his movies. Erica, do you want to say what it is?
Sure. We also went back in time a little bit, just looking at my notes here, because I don't have X-ray eyes, so I have to use glasses to read my notes.
X, the most fantastic experiment you have ever taken part in, presents Ray Milland in his most challenging role since his Academy Award-winning Lost Weekend. X, the man with the X-ray eyes.
Are you all right? It's like the splitting of the world. More light than I've ever seen. Filled with light.
X, the man with the X-ray eyes, tries to help the most desperate in our society and enjoys all the delights of secretly studying sexology.
Headache?
No, it's just my eyes.
We watched this. I think the through line here would be Dick Miller. Does also make an appearance in
makes
this
an appi- makes an appearance
in this one as well. It's horror, it's science fiction, it's a thriller. Essentially opens with Dr. James Xavier, played by Ray Milland, who is performing experiments and trying to see if he can, I guess, enhance eyesight.
Correct. He wants to do X-ray eyes. I mean, he wants X-ray sight. He's a doctor, yeah. And so he's looking to create X-ray vision, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And spoiler alert, he succeeds. But at what cost? It is a wild ride from him experimenting on a monkey, on animals, specifically a little monkey. The monkey does not survive the experiment, does get X-ray eyes, but does not survive. So he decides the natural next step is to experiment on himself.
Naturally.
Naturally. Naturally. Despite his friends and his colleagues not wanting to do this, he goes through with it. It works. It's a success.
Yep.
He starts out on a positive note. He uses it for good. He looks at a young girl who is sick and identifies what is wrong with her. She's having a heart condition, and he intervenes and saves her because he knows the true way that she needs this heart operation. But in doing so, he risks his medical license, and he harms another surgeon in the process because he won't listen to him and doesn't believe him. So he gets pulled into malpractice. So he decides, I can't go through a malpractice suit. I should run away. So he takes off
and joins the carnival.
Natural next steps. When you are a scientist surgeon and you get X-ray vision and it doesn't work out, carnival work. Natural next steps.
That's where he gets into. Don Rickles is in the movie playing the guy that is running the act for Ray Milland to play Dr. X, where he comes in with like a blindfold over his eyes, but he can still see, uses his X-ray vision. Don Rickles is so good in this movie. He is really good. And of course he plays a sleazebag, which, Don Rickles could play an angry sleazebag pretty well, but he's really good in this movie.
Well, if you guys ever find me in a carnival, you'll know two things. One, I've cured my poor eyesight. And mm-hmm. Two, my house is full of dead monkeys. So
the latter I could see happening almost on any day.
Oh, no.
You got to feed your monkeys. And I tell you that all the time, Mark.
Also a fine print item.
Yes. Please feed your monkeys. Yeah, I, Eric and I did watch this movie. We watched it separate. So I'm curious what her thoughts are, because I really, really dug this movie. X is really good. It's very interesting because it's, as Erica was saying, it starts sort of like, you know, light. Like there's a scene where he goes to a party and you can see everyone naked. You had to be a scene that Roger was like, I mean, imagine if he had not made this in 1963, but he'd made this in 1973, mm-hmm. would have shot it very differently. And his commentary even says like, you couldn't shoot it this way now. And I'm like, you would have shot it a totally much more salaciously if you had shot it in any other decade. But it gets very dark. And the end of the movie, he is really suffering and it's a really difficult road, but I feel like Roger handles it really, really well. It's a movie that he came up with a story for, but he didn't write the script. He's initially going to make it about somebody doing drugs and sort of going, I guess, because the drugs take him off the deep end. And then he was halfway through that treatment and was like, nah, and he changed it. But and he thinks it's like fine. Like in the book, The Movie World of Roger Corman, he talks about how he thought it was, you know, it was good, but he didn't feel like it turned out as well. He, at this point, of course, is doing in the middle of his post cycle. This movie shot over 15 days. So he has a pretty good amount of time to shoot it. And you can tell he's also working with Daniel Haller, who was like his production designer for so many of his movies and does such a great job setting up all the sets and environments. He also shoots a little bit outside, but I think he's embarrassed by the effects. But I actually really dug the effects, and I think you did too, Erica, right?
I did. I also really liked this movie. It takes you on a ride that I did not anticipate I would go on when it first started, and the ending is dark. Mm-hmm. It is mm-hmm. very dark. It really takes a turn, and all those light moments that kind of led you here to this point, you're like, okay, wow. Spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear how it ends now, plug your ears or tear out your eyes, because that's what happens here. His eyes turn black and they sort of look like snake eyes for a moment, and then they turn completely black. He has left Don Rickles and gone to a casino because he decides he needs to have all this money. And so, of course, he's counting the cards and, you know, looking through the machines and seeing wins. But when they call him on it, on counting the cards, he just tosses the money up into the air for everyone and then runs. Runs away, drives away, can't see. Again, Terrence's point, you see the special effects, which is just kind of like blurred, you know, kind of gels over the screen. But I think it's effective in that you see then the deterioration of his supervision, of his x-ray vision. Crashes the car, kind of stumbles upon this sort of desert religious group. And they're all kind of listening to a preacher and kind of do his sermon, stumbles in there. And at this point, his eyes are completely black. And by the, you know, guidance of the preacher, he's like, I've seen something, I can't unsee it. And they kind of lead him to it. They're like, well, then if you've seen the devil, then you kind of pluck out your eyes. And he does it.
Yeah. It's like, if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's and a split second. It's a split second. Like if you blink, you could miss it. Like it's a very, very, very quick effect. And it's like right at the tail end of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's such a great dark ending. And it just showed like Roger was in such a zone at this point in time, I feel like, because he's about ready to do Mask of the Red Death. Like he's it's between that and I think Haunted Palace. I think he makes this. And it's just he's like really knows what he's doing. And I'm not sure. I think the effects maybe is why he doesn't look back on this one as favorably. But so many people, like Joe Dante, so many people love this one. This is like their favorite of his movies. And Kayla, I'm assuming you've obviously seen it.
Yeah, no, I've seen it. I think it was actually the first Roger Corman movie really? I ever saw as a child.
Wow.
My dad. You know, I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, and we had these two channels, Channel 20 and Channel 50, that came in from like Detroit or Cleveland or something. And they always had, there was always horror movies. And my dad loved kind of 60s horror movies and stuff. And so he would always like let me watch them with him. And so a lot of Hammer films and AIP films and stuff, that was kind of how I saw them as a kid. And I didn't know who any of the people were, obviously. Like, my dad would get excited about certain actors, and I didn't know who they were, but I remember being freaked out by the ending of this movie. And then I saw it again, like, in my 20s, and haven't seen it since then. So it's been, like, you know, over 30 years since I saw it the last time.
Wow.
But I remembered it going very dark at the end because it freaked me out as a kid.
Yeah, it's an interesting movie because, like Erica was saying, it's sort of a blend of, like, he did some of the creature feature 50s movies, but then it's sort of a little bit of the darker stuff. And it's right before I think he starts doing some more of his counterculture, you know, experimental movies and his biker movies. So it's right in that zone where he's, like, about ready to make that transition. He's going to start really experimenting. And this does, at least with the effects, which is like a blend of, like, camera angles and opticals. It is at least like an interesting attempt at trying to get very experimental and a little bit darker. And this is kind of, and he sort of is going there. And by the end of the 70s, of course, he and AIP, which is, he's basically made them one of the biggest independent distributors. As you mentioned in your book, they start having a bit of a divorce because they're ironically, because they cut up a lot of his movies, which he didn't care for, but didn't mind doing for anyone else. So including Cockfighter.
The funny thing about Cockfighter getting cut and having second unit stuff in it and everything. And even when they later tried to release it with the footage in it from, you know, various other, I can't remember what the movies were, but it was, you know, car chases and nurses and whatever, like the sort of footage that they were trying to put in as the dream sequence or whatever. You know, it was weird that, like, Monty Hellman had already divorced himself from the movie before that happened, because Lewis Teague worked on, you know, some of that second unit stuff. And I asked him in the book about the, you know, like, how could Monty not care? Like, Monty gives you a job on his movie, and then he goes away and you add footage into his movie. Like, why didn't he care about that? Like, I have a hard time believing that, like, an auteur like Monty would not care. And he was just like, he honestly didn't care. Like, I wouldn't have done it if I thought he cared, you know? But it was like, at that point, he already felt like it wasn't the movie he wanted to make. He already didn't like it, you know? So it was like, when they started cutting it and changing it or whatever, he was already at the point where he didn't care. He was ready to go, you know, work on something else that he could have control over. But yeah.
Yeah. But
it's interesting how Roger will attempt to re-release things, retitle things. Like, he does these, you know, he just tries to give a movie its best shot, you know, whatever that might look like. So.
Yeah. He doesn't give up on movies, and it doesn't give up on Cockfighter, because he retitled it, Gambling Man and Born to Kill, and gives it a bunch of different titles and re-releases it and just keeps trying to make money on it. Though I don't think he was he ultimately successful in making money? I mean, I think maybe over the totality of the years.
I think over its whole life, yes, because I think, like, in the early 80s there was a bit of a reappraisal of it, and, you know, so it was I think it played on cable and stuff like that, you know, so it was so I think it eventually made its money, but he was always proud of it, you know, like, he always thought it was a good movie, you know. And I always just felt bad that people, that it wasn't the hit that he thought it was going to be, because he always thought it was a good movie. So
he thought it was just going to be a huge movie, which is why he just jumped right in, because he just thought with a title like that, he thought it was going to do so well. And I think he said, does he say in his memoir, he says that he didn't realize that people were embarrassed by cockfighting in southern states, but they didn't want it called out.
Well, he's like, he was going by the statistics of, like, how much cockfighting there is in America. So he's thought, wow, if there's that many people cockfighting, there's got to be a big audience for this movie, you know? And then, it was the kind of image of the South that everybody was trying to get away from, you know? So it was like, yes, it was real. Yes, those numbers were there, but it was very much a culture that the South was, you know, it was like the new South, you know, that started being created in the 70s. And they're trying to get away from that. And it was interesting, like talking about some of Corman's other films, like, so, you know, when he, cause he does like a handful of more traditional sort of Dixiexploitation type movies in the '70s. And I was really struggling with trying to figure out, well, if the South is trying to get away from this stuff, how did like Smokey and the Bandit become so popular, you know? And then I found this like scholar who had written this book where he really breaks down the difference that was created psychologically between the redneck and the good old boy, you know, and he talks about how the good old boy was a positive thing and the redneck was a bad thing. And there were certain things that rednecks did. And so those movies were bad, but anything that a good old boy did was still acceptable, you know? And it was this, it was very weird, you know, and it's a theory, but I feel like it kind of works when you match it up with the movies that became popular, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Roger had definitely done a lot of, you know, movies like sort of Hicksploitation, if you will, kind of films. Though eventually after, he hadn't really done a lot of it leading into Cockfighter, which is interesting. He'd really done a lot of more mm-hmm. the nurses stuff and the women in prison movies. Mm-hmm. But he hadn't really done a whole lot of those kinds of movies, but he does do them afterwards, like Great Texas Dynamite Chase and, you know, Eat My mm-hmm. Dust and a lot of those kinds of movies, which did better for him.
But a big difference is that there's much more female centric storylines in many of those mm-hmm. films, you know? So it's like, that was the one thing that was really missing from Cockfighter from a traditional Corman film was there was no role for a woman, you know, to play a strong character. Like there just was no Corman girl, if we call them Corman girls, right? There's no Corman girl in the movie. And so it was kind of like based on a book 10 years earlier. And so this kind of the sexual politics of the movie were very outdated by that point compared to the kind of stuff that Corman was making. And so when he had more success later in the '70s with his Southern pictures, you know, so many of them forefronted strong women, you mm-hmm. know, and that was one of the things he was good at. So.
Well, Kayla, thank you so much for joining us on this. This was awesome. I can't wait to watch your movie. That was a great pick. I love your book. I can't wait to read the rest of it. I just got it, so I can't wait to dive into the rest of it. It is, and I know you had to wait for the interior, the design, but the design is beautiful. The inside of the book is meticulously designed. It's beautiful to look at. So thank you so much. Where can people buy the book? Where would you like people to go buy it?
They can buy it either on my website, spectacularoptical.com, or they can buy it pretty much anywhere online because it's now being distributed by Fab Press. And so they have kind of wider distribution. So you should be able to find it on Amazon. It should be kind of in the system where book retailers can order it if people want to order it at their local bookstore, you know. It is widely available.
And tell us why, before you go, tell us why your next book is going to be about cover girl models. It just seems like an odd choice, but.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, close to that. I did go through a minor obsession with the movie Centerfold Girls, where I was like, I'm a locations nerd, you know? So that's one of my things is like, I get obsessed with trying to find like a look, you know, I can't watch a movie without stopping it to like try to figure out where the place is that they're at in the movie. But yeah, I'm actually working. My next book that I write is actually about the history of horror fans on screen.
Oh, okay.
So it's like, the depiction of the horror fan. So it's not about horror fandom in real life, although obviously it'll have to touch on that, but it's really on the changes in the depiction of horror fans in film and television, you know.
I can't wait for
1950s sitcoms, you know, up through like Chainsaw and Dave and Morgan Stewart's Coming Home in the 80s, you know, up to now where everybody's a horror fan in a movie and they don't even have to comment on it anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a great book. I can't wait. I think this is fantastic. Everybody check out Kayla's books. Thank you so much for being here. Roger, thank you so much for being an incredible director and an incredible filmmaker. We celebrate you every single year. Some great movies that we got to see. Please go check all those out. If you like the show and you want to hear all of our past birthday celebrations, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find out all of our stuff. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Hello, this is Aaron West. I am the author of the A24 New Wave. In this book, I look at A24's output and I make the argument that we are in a new wave movement right now. A24 plays a major role. This book has a supplemental podcast where each episode is a brief conversation about an A24-related topic, whether an actor, director, or even a genre. As I continue research for the book and conduct interviews, I expect to record podcast episodes with people involved with the company. You can find the podcast at cinejourneys.com or wherever you find podcasts, and we are proud to be members of the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.